And there it is. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 5 of the Beautiful Struggle podcast. I'm the host, Octavius A. Newman. It's been a while. It's been a long while, long stretch of time since another podcast is going down. But we're back, and I'm here with my old head OG, triple OG, Josh Wan, a.k.a. Esso. That's what they call him in the streets.
Yeah. What's up, doggy?
Yeah. We did it. We're trying to do this for a long time, trying to make this happen for a minute. Yeah, I have been trying to wrestle you down and get you into the studio to do a podcast for a while, but finally you're here.
Glad to be here.
I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Stepping down from the throne and to the regular peoples, a.k.a. me, do a podcast with me. I appreciate it.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So the reason why I have Josh on the podcast is because I really admire this guy. He's an entrepreneur. He is the owner of Lamp Mode Recordings. He's also got a media company, Scouts Outer Media. He's done a lot of photo and video for Bear Fruit. And he's also a guy that when I first started doing Bear Fruit, when I first started brainstorming and talking about what I wanted my logo to be and what I wanted my idea to be. I've probably talked this guy's ear off about so many half-baked ideas over the years. And he's just politely done a slow head nod and going, yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Go out and do it.
Yeah, you should probably go do that and stop telling me about the same thing over and over and over again. So, man, he's a wealth of knowledge. I just called him up today and was asking him about some advice, and he's always been willing to tell me what he thinks, give me honest feedback, encourage me. And I just think he's a person whose story is worth telling and worth hearing. And hopefully you guys can be inspired by him you guys can get a little bit of inspiration from him. Probably not what I've gotten over the many years, but just a little something from him telling us his story. So why don't you tell the people kind of like, if you had to overview yourself, who's Josh Wan?
Who is Josh Wan? Well, right now I'm a husband, father of two beautiful little boys. I see myself as a video maker, filmmaker, and try to limit it to that at this point. So my goal is to be the best I can be and kind of cut out any distractions that would keep me from pursuing that.
Mm. So you got a lot of options, a lot of possibilities to say yes, but you're trying to narrow those down into...
Definitely, man. I mean, I think that's one of the sort of regrets I have looking back over the last 15 years of my professional career is that I've tried to do too much. Mm. And, you know, if you pursue something for too long, and, you know, the downside is that, or the challenge is you don't know what you're going to want to do necessarily in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that understanding that, you know, in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I can regret what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the more you can have sort of a focus on that one thing you want to do and try and go after it, you know, more than anything else, is one of the things I've learned. And so, you know, I've done, my background is in DJing, and from DJing I've got into engineering, producing, mastering, and then from that into video and some graphic design in there as well. And so I've always sort of juggled some of that stuff, you know, simultaneously. And the reality is you can only be, you know, so good at you know, one of those things.
Mm.
And people could pursue one of those things for their lifetime and still not be great at it.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's called a discipline, is because you choose one thing and you try to be disciplined at, you know, cultivating just a skill set that lasts, I guess, your lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's heavy right there, even the start. I mean,
hey.
That's really deep to think about, even for me. There's so many things, like I said, half-baked ideas. I have half-baked ideas every day. And what I mean by half-baked ideas, like this, you know, if you think about, if you put something in the oven and it doesn't finish cooking, and then you take it out, and then you try to eat it, like brownies, they kind of drip and all that kind of stuff. That's like what a lot of my ideas are. But one of the challenges I've had is taking an idea, committing to it, seeing it all the way through and taking action, not just having an idea and thinking about it and talking about it and being excited about it, but actually doing something with it. So that's even challenging for me, just to hear you say, I'm trying to find, out of all the things I could be doing, I'm trying to choose something and do that and do that really well. Have you seen the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
I have not seen that yet. I do want to see it, though.
Yeah, like that's one of the things that, one of the things I got from the documentary is this guy's dedicated his entire life to making sushi. I mean, his apprentice, I think they said, you need to think about dedicating 10 to 20 years to do this if you really even want to start.
Wow.
But how do you, I mean, even going back to the beginning, like when you first started being a creative person, you said, well, where did you start? How did your creative journey begin?
How did I start? Well, I started, so kind of where I'm at now, if I trace it back to the beginning, I would trace it back to, I guess, skateboarding.
Hmm.
And so through skateboarding and actually the music that skateboarding introduced me to, I got into DJing.
Hmm.
And so that opened up this world to me. Back when, I started skating when I was young,
right.
8, 9 years old, and had older cousins that were always kind of into, skating and more underground culture.
Mm-hmm.
So they just introduced me to a lot of that stuff, my older brother as well. So I grew up in that sort of 80s skate culture, Pal Peralta. And then stuck with skateboarding and then got into, just from watching skate videos, you'd hear like, oh, Delta Funky Homo Sapien, and then you'd like go and buy his tape and get introduced to music that way. So from that, I got introduced into DJing, and then, fell in love with DJing and really pursued that from the time of high school past college.
Mm.
I was heavily involved in DJing, and then that opened up these other doors, which is the natural progression of DJing, is to get into production and studio work.
Yeah. Is that what you normally see happens? Or did you have a lot of people who you're DJing with, or was it just you?
My brother started DJing. We had other friends that DJed. So it was, it became one of those things that it was just everyone was hanging out and jump on the turntables and start to mess around. And some people stuck with it and others didn't. Mm-hmm. So it was just one of those things that we were doing, in high school, having fun with.
Now, you could have taken the route of rapping. Why'd you choose the DJ instead
of... That sucked.
Did you try? You tried to do it?
Everyone tries to rap.
Do you remember any of your bars?
Yeah.
I know you got bars, deep cuts.
Yeah.
Can we get some old...
Can't do
SO
it.
Bars?
Nope.
Share with the world. This is what the people want. The people want these bars.
Can't do it, man. Sorry.
Okay. You're going to... Yeah. That's what you talked about. You talked about focusing on one discipline.
Yeah.
Okay, you could.
I mean,
everyone
got a sketchbook, and you only show about 5% of your work, So
yeah, okay.
None of it's worth showing.
All right, I got you. So the DJing, and how'd you go on from there? What happened from there?
So DJing was a hobby through high school and college, and after college, I thought I would get a job as a television director. And that's what I wanted to do.
Now, how'd you make that jump? That's a big jump.
Well, I went to school for communications and art minor. So, yeah, I fell in love with directing, television directing, live sort of news type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, like a lot of kids do coming out of school, is that you'll graduate and you'll have 80 people like knocking on your door trying to hire you.
Yeah. The American dream. All I got to do is get this degree.
Yeah,
and everything will fall right in place.
Definitely not the case. So as I entered the professional world, I was further along in terms of my skill set with DJing and music. And when I was 17 or 18, I opened a record store with my brother. And
opened a record store?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, we opened a record store in Pittsburgh. And
what was it called?
There was a record store called Hypervinyl. That was my friend's store. He did a lot of like Detroit techno and other things, dance music. So within his record store, we opened up our own little subsection and just did all the hip hop. So through that, I learned how to work with distributors, sort of the the ins and outs of the behind the scenes of the record industry. And, you know, coming from underground DJ culture, everything was independent, do it yourself. So I had that sort of mindset, you know, throughout. And the music I liked with hip hop tended to be more independent, you know, kind of like the mid-90s independent stuff from New York. Based on that and just being involved in this music world in Pittsburgh, I'd put out probably 17, 18 mixtapes at that point.
So you're DJing, like, now when you say mixtape now, 2015, is different from mixtape, you know, back in what year is this?
So this is, I mean, the first mixtape I released was probably 95, 96.
Where can the people get this mixtape?
You can't get them
doesn't
anymore.
Doesn't exist.
Nah. Okay. There's a few on like DatPiff and stuff, but.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's under an old name that.
That you will not disclose?
Nah, yeah.
Gotta go looking for it. Okay.
Yeah, you gotta find it, man.
But find it, let me know. So define mixtape from.
So mixtape at that point, especially, you know, coming from DJ culture, is putting a cassette tape into a deck.
First of all, what is a cassette tape?
Hey.
For all the 90s babies out there.
Cassette tape, you know, it's a little magnetic reel of some sort of magical stuff that holds music. So yeah, you put the cassette in and hit record, and you have 30 to 45 minutes on each side and one take.
You had to flip the sides. I remember that.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah, that would be a mixtape, and then we would go to Kinko's and print out, you know, 100, 200 covers, cut them up, and then put them all together and sell them out of our backpack, sell them at stores, sell them through the distributor. So yeah, that's pretty much what I did coming, you know, through high school and college. So the dream was to, just as a hobby, start a record label, just as a way to put out music, you know, that me and my friends were making. So out of school, not able to get the television directing job that I wanted.
So you actually went for the television directing job,
yeah,
and they just weren't coming together.
Well, see, the thing is, to get into that world, you have to be willing to move to a smaller market and kind of work your way up, which I was too proud to do.
Do you mind if I ask, like, probe a little bit? When you say you're too proud to do, what does that mean from your perspective?
Well, one, I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. And so my family, you know, they've always kind of worked for themselves. They've been blue collar sheet metal workers. So entering into this world of kind of career path was new territory. So I didn't have someone telling me, okay, this is what it looks like to get involved into a career and to get involved with, you know, a large network, like a television station, and how to work your way up. So that goes back to the mindset of me just thinking, oh, I'm going to graduate and I'm going to be making X amount of dollars right off the bat and life will be good. So I couldn't get hired in Pittsburgh because it's a, you know, larger market, which is where I was living. Didn't want to move to, like, you know, like a Scranton, Harrisburg, et cetera. Just because who wants to live there, right? You know,
Michael Scott.
Yeah.
That's about it.
But, I mean, it's sort of short-sighted to think that way, because if I really wanted to do it, it would be worth it. And being, you know, in your young 20s, that's the time to do it.
Yeah.
When you can sort of bounce back from that sooner and you have, you don't have a family or whatever. But I didn't know this. So to me, it was kind of like all or nothing. So I was like, oh, well, forget it. Like, I'm not going to do that. So let me just pursue this music thing and start a record label out of college.
And this is Lamp Mode?
This is Lamp Mode, yeah.
Now, did you?
Well, Lamp Mode started as a label called Sick and Tired Records.
Sick and Tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sick and Tired Records.
Were you sick and tired of what, though?
Sick and, I mean, it's kind of like that underground, like, mindset of, like, you know, F the world and we're going to do things our way.
Sick of this. You know what? Do it myself.
Yeah. You know, you just, you know, underground. Back then, like, and still it's kind of this way, but, you know, rap artists like to complain about things.
Rappers complain?
Offer. Yeah.
Get out of here.
That's what happens, man. You know, critical things.
Yeah.
Not always able to offer a solution. So I think it was just that mindset of, you know, screw the major labels. We're going to do it our way.
Now, was this coming from you trying to do things and them not working out your way? Or was this just like an inherited heritage kind of like attitude kind of thing.
Yeah, it was just, you know, this is the way that the underground culture does it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, as
Sick and Tired is what you started out of college.
Yeah, Sick and
with
Tired.
Your brother?
No. He was kind of out of the picture at this point. So yeah, started as Sick and Tired, and then from there moved to Philadelphia, and within about a year, kind of abandoned that and started Lamp Mode. But Lamp Mode was the name of the studio in Pittsburgh.
That you created?
Yeah, so the label was Sick and Tired Records, and then I have some mixtapes around here that would be like Sick and Tired Records, and then like recorded at Lamp Mode Studios.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have two questions.
Sure.
Because a couple of things just hit me. One, how do we get from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia? I mean, or why? Why did we move to Philadelphia?
Timothy Brindle, who is a rapper, artist, and was the first artist put out on Lamp Mode Recordings. I met Tim at a rave, 2001, April, in Pittsburgh. We were both indulging in a lot of foreign substances.
Okay.
He knew who I was based on, you know, my mixtape heritage.
Because you were blow-up-shuating.
Yeah, you know, Pittsburgh is a small scene. I was like a figure in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a crew that was making noise, and...
What was the crew?
Crew was Deadly Scribes' crew.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a subgroup called the Parts of Speech.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of Speech all went to Temple University.
Okay.
So he was from Pittsburgh, but going to school in Temple.
Okay.
So he was out here in Philly.
Mm-hmm.
So met him at that rave. He knew who I was. I knew who he was. He actually recognized me from my face on the cover of a mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the first time my face had ever been on the cover of a mixtape.
So before this, you were basically Ghostface Killah.
It was just like graph and art, you know.
I'm saying, but like in the same
thing,
no one had seen, no one know who is this guy.
Well, I mean,
were you DJ Esso at this time, Essence?
Yeah, DJ Essence. Yeah.
Okay.
So they would have recognized me from, you know, doing shows and things like that. But if you didn't know me, you would just know the name.
Right.
So yeah, so there's one time I did an album with my boy Drastic, and you know, he was more kind of like commercialish, Clue, DJ Clue-ish type guy.
Mm-hmm.
So for him, it was more like promo marketing, put your faces on it. So I did. But Tim had saw that album, so he knew what I looked like. So we were just kind of like crossing paths at this rave.
Right.
He saw me and was like, you know, stopped to talk to me. Now, only a month or two before that, I had found out who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And out of this whole crew of five guys, he was the one I liked the best.
Mm.
So as I was listening, you know, to the album, I was like, yo, who is this dude? You know, his name was Ambush the Animated at the time. Very fitting.
Tim is animated. Yes, he is.
So, we just started talking, exchange numbers. I was like, yo, this is what I'm trying to do. Let's connect. You know, I'm producing and would love to help you, you know, with your music.
Right.
If you ever want to do some solo stuff. So that friendship turned into, a year later, me moving up to Philly.
Mm. And the next question is Lamp Mode. Where does the name Lamp Mode come from?
So in Pittsburgh, people would say lampin', like as a way to like flip chillin' or coolin' or whatever.
Right.
So I'm like lampin'.
Right.
So it's kind of like chill mode, cool mode, lamp mode. Just like flipping that. It's not that deep.
Yeah. this is the answer, folks.
Yeah. So. And I liked a lot of lamps in the studio. You know, if you're in the studio all day, you don't want like bright lights. So I want some nice ambiance. So it's kind of like dual meaning.
Got you.
Yeah.
Has it grown to any other other meaning since then? Or is it kind of like, this is what it's known as and we're just going to leave it at that?
That's what it is.
Okay. Yeah. So we do, you're in Philly. Tim's in Philly. Lamp Mode Recording starts. He's the first artist. And where do we go from there? How does it develop from there?
So from there, we've, started adding other artists. And the quick sort of overview is, 7 artists now, and we've released 35 albums, I think.
Is it 35?
Yeah, in about 12 years.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's about 3 a year.
That's a... Yeah, yeah. That's a lot. Mm-hmm. So who are the artists on Lamp Mode right now?
So right now it's Timothy Brindle, Shy Lin, Hazakim, Stephen the Levite, God's Servant, Jason, and S.O.
Mm-hmm. Not you. S.O.
No, S.O. from London.
Got you.
S.O.
Okay. And I mean, like, and this is not what you foresaw.
This was not my idea. No, I mean, it wasn't. Yeah, this wasn't a conceived idea.
You weren't like, I'm gonna tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to have this record label.
It was more of, the label was just a necessary evil to put out music. Mm-hmm. So it was more of, okay, we have to make a business. We have to, like, do all of these things officially so that we mm-hmm. can make music and not have to go the traditional route. And back then, I mean, it's easier now with the internet because mm-hmm. it's kind of like, you know, anyone can put out music and you have a platform. But yeah. back then, there was a little more, like, needed to go into, okay, we need to, like, officially do all these things. Whereas now, it's kind of like, all I need is, you know, to sign up on a certain website and I can put my music out through yeah. iTunes. Mm. But, you know, back then is a little bit, at least perception-wise, it seemed like, okay, you need a little bit of a bigger team to put out music.
Yeah. So how's your role, like, what role do you play in Lamp Mode now? I mean, because that is a long time, 12 years. What's an iPhone 12 years ago? What's Facebook, Twitter, you know, SoundCloud?
Like, those didn't exist.
Even DJs aren't, you know, mixtapes. And I mean, this is a completely different world when it comes to music now. Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of changes have you seen? And what kind of role are you playing now in comparison to how it was before?
Yeah, well, the changes are, you know, it's hard to put your finger on. I think that's what everyone's trying to do is, like, figure out, you know, where are we at now? Where are mm-hmm. things going? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, some of the bigger changes are there's just so much music out there that mm. it's hard to even get anyone's attention. Mm. So, literally, I can listen to anything I want whenever I want
right.
for as long as I want yeah. for free.
Spotify, Apple Music now.
Yeah.
What else? Tidal.
Tidal, Beats, I mean, Google Pandora, Play, all those. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, music just isn't valuable anymore. And so, industry-wise, you know, labels are trying to figure out how do we package music to make it something that we can monetize. The whole streaming thing is changing things, which I'm a fan of. Mm-hmm. As a fan, and I think as a label, I think it's just a long-term sort of shift where it'll take time to catch up. So probably the best example of why that is first week sales are always a big thing in the traditional model because mm-hmm. you know, for a year, dump X amount of money into a project, 2 years, you put it out, and then you want to see a return as quick as possible on right. that project. So you sort of pump all of this effort into getting people's attention so that when that album drops, you can recoup your money.
Right.
Now, in a streaming model, but so when you get people's money, you might not ever see their money again, you know, period.
Right.
And they can enjoy this album for the next 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
In a streaming model, it's not that you're going to get money up front. You're going to get this sort of shallow, extended stream of money. Mm-hmm. If someone's listening to your album for the next 30, 40, 50 years, it might actually equate to $20, $30, $40 that they've spent on your music.
Right.
So it's changing the model in that sense. So, and it'll take time to catch up because there's this sort of, now we're in this weird in-between phase where everyone's operating in the model of, okay, we need to get money now, but it's sort of, you know, evening out to where it's going to take maybe 5-10 years to recoup on an album.
Mm. So how does that, I mean, this is not what you decided that you wanted to do. This is kind of where you're at right now mm-hmm. with music. And now you find yourself, you know, the owner of Lamp Mode Recordings. And it's not even how it was when you first started it. So how do you continue to, like, participate and grow and develop with the world as the way people are consuming what your company is making is changing? Or are you kind of yeah. still just rolling with it?
I'm still kind of rolling with it, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a president now. Shout out to Jason, who's doing a great job, one of the artists.
Shout out to Jason, yeah.
So he stepped in as president, I think, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Just given my lack of interest and time in sort of the music industry. Mm. And has been someone to sort of fill in the gaps of my absence. So one of the things that happened that was interesting is the label grew beyond my interest level in terms of what I wanted to even be involved with and what I wanted it to be.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like you to expound on that if you could. Because as soon as you said Yeah, I wasn't, you know, grew beyond my interest. I was like, huh, that's, because, you know, you think about someone who's successful, and I think a lot of times you might equate success with enjoyment or success with passion. Oh, you're successful, so you must love it. But for you to hear, for one, from the outside looking in, to look at Lamp Mode, and this is the owner of Lamp Mode, and sitting down, we're hearing from him, and he's like, yeah, my company has grown beyond my interest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? How did that happen?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what that looks like is now there are a lot more pieces to manage, mm-hmm. and there's a lot more things to juggle, and there's a lot of things that command your time and attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go back to, you know, what I stated in the beginning of it, just being a necessary thing that was so that we can make music, you know, with our friends and put it out, it's kind of grown beyond that. Now it's like, we have to be more strategic in thinking about, you know, budgets are bigger. We need to, you know, make money back. And if we don't make money back, then it affects the next, you know, things in line and other artists down the road. So all of those things where it's become more of the machine that I wanted to avoid in the beginning.
That you were sick and tired of.
Yeah. But in being naive, you know, a young, naive kid in the underground, now I see I'm not as critical of the sort of machine and, you know, major labels that I was, because I'm sympathetic with just the
necessity.
Yeah. The necessity and the things that go into it. And it's just a different thing, you know, but it's not as, you know, it's not as interesting to me.
Yeah. I found that a lot of times, even for me, when you have your mindset of what you think this thing's going to be, it's almost like this fantasy. You look at something and you go, oh, this is what my experience is going to be. Or you're critical of something. You're like, that's dumb. Why would they do that? If I was interested. And then you actually get into it and you're like, oh, okay. I understand why they do that now. And I understand, like, I mean, it's hard to think well of people, you know, in business. And it's hard to look at a big, gigantic business and you being one person. You know, you think, why doesn't, you know, so-and-so just make this decision? It's simple. But when you actually get into it, there's all these moving parts. And I can understand how it'd be like, ugh, I am not interested in doing this. I just wanted to make music. Now you're asking me to worry about this. And what the heck is a Facebook? Like, what's Twitter? I got to tweet and I got to answer questions. Oh, no, this is not what I want.
Yeah.
You know, I can relate to that. I can relate to that. You know, hopefully people can listen, can relate to that too. So did you feel any kind of like responsibility to keep going? Cause I know that for me, you know, if you start something, I felt like, well, I have to keep doing it. You know, I'm responsible. I started this thing. You know, my lack of interest is maybe not a good reason to stop participating. Did you have any kind of wrestle with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably why I'm still involved to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And so I've backed away in a lot of ways, and especially having these other people involved, which has been helpful. So I would say that I feel responsible. I do feel responsible to keep it going, because I think the longer you've done something, you just feel invested into it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I think people stay in bad relationships, because it's like you feel like
somebody just got free.
Yeah, man.
You just freed somebody up just now.
Well, I mean, the longer you're in a bad relationship, it's harder to leave it, because
you
feel like all this time has been invested. You feel like you're going to have to like sort of admit that there's been failure. And so it becomes harder to leave.
Start over even.
Yeah, you got to start over, and you can't go back and get all that time. So,
and I'm sure there's even still aspects of it you do enjoy.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
That you don't want to have to go. I mean, comfort, all kinds of things.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's why we're at where we are now, is that let other people kind of come in and do what they do, and then I can sort of just be overseer and, you know, kind of give feedback where necessary.
Mm-hmm. So what's your role now? You're not the president, you are the
owner. Not the president, I'm the owner. I still have, you know, call myself the creative director, although, I mean, that's a debatable title, and what that looks like for us is I try to provide oversight and help the artist achieve anything visually they want by, you know, helping connect the right people to either hire designers and then work with the designers.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of be the quality control visually and kind of the brand manager. mm-hmm. from that standpoint. And then I oversee like the financial stuff still mm-hmm. and, you know, just take care of all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And is Lamp Mode moving in the direction that you want to see it going right now? Or is it still kind of like you're kind of seeing where this goes?
I think we're at an interesting point because we're like, all of our artists are almost, you know, been here from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking for like, what's next? Who are the new artists? We have a very niche brand and it doesn't seem like there's many people that kind of fit what we want to do. So then you have to decide, do we abandon kind of who we are and change that, or do we just try and find like the right person, and with that know that it can still only be so big because it's such a niche thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's that niche for people who don't know what Lamp Mode is?
The niche of Lamp Mode is lyrical theology. So it's kind of those two things combined. So artistically, having artists who are, you know, sort of lyricists to one degree or another, and there's a spectrum even within our label now of that. So you have some that are like heavy lyrical kind mm-hmm. of classic lyricists, mm-hmm. and then you have some that are more, you know, newer artists with hints of lyricism, and then the theological aspect is, and this has a similar spectrum, but content that's theological in nature, and made specifically for the church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So those are kind of the two pieces that we try and keep in mind.
Right.
Yeah.
And as you're saying, like, it's hard to find artists that fit that. Are you seeing that? Why is that? Like, what is there? What's not there? Is too much mm-hmm. of something, not enough of something? When you look out into like the creative music sphere right now.
Yeah, well, I think that there are, one, I think culturally that lyricism in the last few years, although it's coming back to it, I think it's not been as big of an accent point
mm-hmm.
in the genre of just hip hop. So I think that's tough. And then you have the theological aspect where it seems like those who are in, you know, this Christendom music are the sort of people that are leading the way are kind of shifting away from that to be more culturally relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on how you define that, there's a few ways to slice it. Mm-hmm. But so they're influencing, I'd say, like the younger, newer generation mm-hmm. to sort of abandon some of these like more conservative principles that were mm-hmm. there in place. So it just, yeah, there's not that many people doing it because it's not like cool to do right now.
And how do you feel about where, like you said, music is going right now? Some specific things is like there are a lot of artists who are Christians and they are rappers, but it's like, don't call me Christian rapper, or, you know, like you're saying, they're abandoning some more of the, what was the terminology you used, more
conservative principles.
How do you feel about that as someone 12 years ago who started Lamp Mode
mm-hmm.
and Lamp Mode is lyrical theology, as you're looking out into what's going on right now, how do you respond to that?
I think it's good. I mean, I think we need those people. Mm-hmm. And I've never been the type of person to say, this is the way we do it, therefore, like, this is the model. Mm. So I'm not that type of person. I mean, I think we need both.
Yeah.
So overall, I'm excited about it. I think that on both sides, there's inherent issues and flaws and, like, limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Christian music industry in and of itself is a horrible idea. However, wait, I feel like it's a necessary idea.
Wait, back up. Wait a minute. What's a horrible idea?
I think that a Christian music industry in and of itself is not a good idea.
Please explain.
But I think it's inevitable to have it.
Okay.
And so you can't do away with it. I think it's a bad idea because it doesn't perpetuate it places the accent in such a limited way to where there's a deficiency in all the other things that go into making music. And so what it's done is it's tried to box in and, okay, here's the best way to say it.
Okay. Give it to me straight.
You have people that focus on content, and then you have people that focus on the sort of art and the expression of it. Both of those things need to be kept in balance and in view. And I think the Christian music industry historically has placed so much emphasis on content that the artistic expression is neglected. So now you have somewhat of a backlash against that. I think we would be better artists, Christian music artists would be better artists if they were in the general market, because you get so much fanfare and applause for being subpar in the Christian music industry. There's less of a gene pool to pull from. So it's like, if you're gonna have a basketball team, and you could have the world to pick from, you're gonna have a really good basketball team.
Right.
If you're gonna go up and play against a basketball team that can only pull from people in Philadelphia, well, inherently they're limited because they're only pulling from this smaller gene pool.
Right.
And the best of the best in Philly is probably gonna be somewhat average compared to this larger pool of the world.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the dangers of it, and the backlashes or fallouts from it, is that people tend to elevate mediocrity. And I don't think that's good just for art in general.
Yeah. So yeah. You're saying that, like, historically, when you're looking at Christians doing music, you're seeing a lot of like, oh, bless God, praise the Lord, you know, because it's for Jesus.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying, or am I hearing it wrong?
No, yeah, I mean, pretty much. Yeah. Well, I mean, you get that too. Because you're asking the wrong people to give you feedback, and they're only thinking about it in terms of, if X, Y, and Z is there, then it's good.
Right.
But they're not thinking about, you know, the 23 other letters of the alphabet.
Right.
Which are important. And the culture thinks about.
First of all, that was good, if X, Y, and Z, but not thinking of the 23 letters of the alphabet.
I just came up with that.
That was good. My man. Okay. Right. The whole world's going to steal it.
Yeah.
You know, because this podcast is that popular. But, but no, that's really, really insightful. Because I think a lot of people have felt similarly. I know when I was first engaging with art, and engaging with art, you know, it's like there's this weird thing when you are a Christian and at the same time you want to engage and participate in some sort of artistry, you almost feel this responsibility to prioritize, make sure you say Jesus, make sure you say scripture, almost like the only important thing is that you say Jesus. That's the most important thing. Whether you sound good, whether it looks good, whether it tastes good, whether it feels good, those are all secondary. You know, what's most important and what will get most celebrated is the fact that it's, quote, for Jesus. And I remember kind of being like, but it's not good, though. Am I allowed to say that this person can't sing? It's like, but it's for the Lord. Like, people actually argue with you. And it's like, but it's not good. Well, what is good? I mean, because if it's the Lord, technically it's good. Right. And it's like, okay, you're rolling your eyes now and you're like, what are we talking about?
So, exactly, yeah. I think another issue with it is that it tends to reward imitation.
You're saying Christian music
in general. So those that are the best, typically, historically, I mean, there's exceptions.
Yeah.
The exception proves the rule. So that the rule is that whatever's popular in the mainstream, whoever can imitate that most closely and do it sterily, you know, and redeem it, tends to be the most popular artist in Christianity. Which, again, I think is sort of the dog chasing its tail, because you can only be so good at that point. You never hear of the Christian industry rewarding individuality or someone creating a new sound or being known for a sound.
Or you might not even hear a new sound or a new thing coming out of...
Well, you won't hear it because those people don't get a platform.
Okay.
You know, you'll hear it, but it's not going to be elevated and presented because there's no market for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of this weird thing that exists. Now, I think it's necessary because it's good for the church to not have to wade through all of that stuff. But I would also say it's not good for the church to have to wade through all of the other stuff, because that's part of the responsibility of being able to interact with, you know, the world at large. So you shouldn't have to have someone else doing all of that filtering for you. You should be able to, you know, see things and discern, is this good or bad, or is this something I want to digest? Now, obviously, you have children and you know, young adults and teenagers that you know, are exposed to this stuff, and you have parents that want to like protect them from certain things. But that's, you know, that's the role of the parents, not the role of an industry to do that, or a market to do that. But I think what's cool is that the world is moving away from a platform that allows for that, and that would be the internet. So, you know, Christian bookstores are shutting down, which I think it's good. And I say this, you know, I want to be sympathetic to those that are like affected by that, because there are people that I'm sure that's are hurting financially. Yeah. And, you know, that's definitely a downside, but I think it's good that you don't have to go to this, like, you know, isolated bookstore to go buy the music, but like we're all in the same shelf space together.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, similar visibility.
And it also allows people to actually access this content in a way that, you know, they couldn't before. Like, there are artists right now who are popping up through SoundCloud. I mean, I do a lot of listening to stuff on SoundCloud, listen to Soulection, and, you know, I'm finding out about all these artists that otherwise, how would I even know about them? Yep. You know, how would I even come across these people if it wasn't for this whole, you know, sharing kind of concept, being able to be like random people can be tastemakers now versus, you know, this is the place that you go to for the information that you should be listening to, should be reading, should be taking in. Now you can get it from other places. And there are other trusted sources.
Yeah.
But like you're saying, as a result, like the world changes. So old models now, either they got to adapt or it's over for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's insightful from an OG in this industry to kind of talk about like how you started to like how you're seeing it now. And it's also cool for me to hear, because it's, you don't have this black and white mentality about it. It's kind of like, yeah, this is a lot going on. I'm hearing, I don't quite have it figured out, but here's where I stand. Here's what I like. Here's what I think is an opportunity for improvement. Here's what I'm confused on. That's encouraging for me, for someone that you would often look up to and go, oh, he's probably got it all figured out, to go, man, I don't know. And, you know, I'm still kind of just rolling with it too. Still kind of just feeling this thing out. So how, and now with all the music stuff going on, there's a whole nother side of you that is kind of back to the directing and media and the photo and the video stuff.
Yeah, it's really cool. It went full circle. And so, again, this isn't my cleverness or anything, but because of the record label, we found ourselves about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, needing video stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, as always a challenge in business, you desire more than you can afford. So,
oh yeah, I know about it.
Yeah, we would hire people to do video stuff, and it just wasn't the quality that we needed.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was, well, we can invest, you know, a small amount of money, get a camera, and do it ourselves, because I had a little bit of an eye and understanding of, okay, this isn't that good. I think we could do better. Right. So bought a camera and started to do stuff myself. And through that, then people started to be like, oh, you know, because we're in the, you know, small circle of the music industry, other people would see me like, oh yeah, can you do that for me? And so started to kind of pick up these little freelance gigs on the side. Yeah. And then that, you know, that caused me to think through more of, is this what I want to be doing in terms of the music?
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw this, you know, revived desire in video.
Mm.
And other things that went into that would be, you know, everything that happened around this time was, you know, I turned 30, I got married, and I had almost a decade to look back on of what I had done. And, you know, you start to ask yourself, is this where I want to go? How did I get here? Am I happy with this?
Yeah.
And most of those answers were no, like, I'm not happy here. This isn't where I wanted to be. How did I get here?
Mm.
Oh crap. Like, what am I doing? I gotta now backtrack and reposition myself to do something different.
Yeah.
And the video thing had just happened like a year or two prior to that. So I thought, you know, this is something I want to do. I could do this, you know, till I'm dead and love it. Mm. I also feel like it's more accessible in the nature of who I can work with and what I can do as someone involved in just filmmaking. Whereas with music, it's a little bit harder as an engineer, producer in the hip hop industry to navigate some of the issues of working with secular artists. So it would be challenging for me to work with, you know, successful artists in the mainstream, given the nature of their content. And, you know, I've had to turn stuff down because of that in the past. So there's not as much neutral kind of gray area. Whereas with filmmaking, I can work for companies, corporations, organizations, mm-hmm. and other brands, and mm-hmm. it doesn't really have this inherent moral nature to it.
So it's not as it's not as challenging to what your stances are on particular worldviews and stuff like that. And there's more opportunities to participate in things that aren't as black and white. I mean, hip hop is a very, you know what I mean? It has a particular worldview, has a particular way of doing things. And there's a marketing community that's not like that. But the reality of it is like, can you really make a living?
Yeah.
Can you raise a family with this particular worldview, standing for those morals and that way of doing things and making good quality product? And can they pay you?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, those are a lot of hard conversations.
Yeah. Do I want my kids to know what I'm doing? And am I proud of that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, you know, kind of, it wasn't an easy, clear answer like that. I mean, it took a lot of sleepless nights and anxiety and sort of like wondering, like, oh my goodness, like, what am I going to do type thing? But, that's what's happening. So from that, started a separate media company, Scouts Honor Media, and we make videos for people.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing you just said that I kind of wanted to go back to, you said it was sleepless nights, anxiety, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's the, how did you deal with that? Like, you know, because it's one thing to say, here's my story.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. But I think the things that I'm most inspired by is when I hear, this sucked. This was hard. I don't know. I didn't know what I was going to do. And this is what I actually did. And this is what happened. Mm. How did you deal with, man, I look back over the past decade. How did I get here? What am I doing? Oh, no. This isn't what I want to do. Even though, like, someone might walk up to you and go, what? You got a company and everybody loves it. And you got this huge following and so on, so and so. But you sit there, you know, and you're laying in the bed looking at the ceiling like, no. Like, what is, you know, what was that like?
I wish I kind of had a good answer for that. I think it looks like whenever anyone is anxious about something, you are consumed with it in your mind. You can't stop thinking about it. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're going to do. You feel trapped. And, I can't remember how long it went on for, but I know that it was heavy on me, and I know that it was affecting my health and other things, just the stress, you know, and the weight of it. But, you know, it was a process, you know, of just talking to people about it, talking to my wife about it, and trying to figure it out. But
and this is not stress that's brought on from a lack of success.
No, it's more of an internal, like, you know, wrestling through desires and it depends how you define success.
Okay.
You know, like, is it success in the sense of this is what I want to do? Or is it success in the sense of this has been able to achieve a certain thing, you know? And I guess, you have to sort of define which one is successful or not.
So how do you define success?
I would define it as this is something that I want to do and where I want to be right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would say it wasn't successful in that sense of, I don't look at it as this was a successful venture in terms of this. Now, there are things that allowed me to get to where I'm at. So it wasn't a disaster per se, but, sort of double-edged sword, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I would say it's a success in some degree, but not of an ultimate, like, this is what, you know, I want to die doing.
Yeah.
Thing. So it was, you know, it's like a puppy love romance. Mm. You know, it's kind of like you have fun with it, but then it can quickly become like disastrous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can relate. I can relate to what you're talking about just like there's so many people that you can, that can come to you and go, man, I'm not where I want to be. And I think a lot of creative people struggle with that. They wrestle with that. Like, there's this either or thing. Do I get a job doing what I have to do, or do I pursue what I want to do? And then there's, well, how much of that can I really expect in real life? Can I expect to be fulfilled? Can I expect to be happy? Can I expect to feel passionate? What happens when the passion goes away? You know, like, that, I don't even know if I have an answer for that. I mean, that's something that I'm wrestling with myself. That's why I'm kind of like wanting to dig a little bit more into that, because there, that's a reality. Passions come and go. Feelings come and go. Happiness and sadness. There's this up and down to it. But how do you, what do you anchor yourself to as a creative person? Like, is a gust of wind going to come and go, man, I don't feel fulfilled from this photo and video stuff? You know, what's the anchor? Or do you have one?
Well, I think I've got to the point where I would say that the video stuff's not going to fulfill me, and I'm not going to find it satisfying, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think this is where like my faith would come into play, and understanding that the world in and of itself is not going to fill the need that I have and a longing for something more. That can only come through God and like what He does in His Son Jesus Christ and forgiving us of our sins, right? So I think there's that understanding of knowing that's liberating in the sense of, you know what? Because what happens in my mind is I always romanticize everything. So it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to start this company and it's just going to be amazing. It's going to be so easy. And this is what we're going to do. And people are going to look at it and it's going to be like awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get it and you're sort of like, dang, this is not what I thought it would be.
It's
you
not know? What I signed up for.
So it's we never envision it being mediocre because otherwise we wouldn't pursue it, right?
Yeah.
So in our minds, it's always going to be better than it will be in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why you see, you know, so many successful people dealing with depression, committing suicide, et cetera, because they get it and then realize, you know, there's nothing else. So I think once you understand that, it's easy for me to work on something, put my all into it, and not be satisfied with it and know that, you know what, I shouldn't be, I'm not surprised by that.
Mm.
You know, it's,
okay.
There's a liberation that comes, understanding this is part of what life in this sort of fallen world looks like.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'm sort of like, okay, you know what? Big deal. I'm done with work. Let me go enjoy my wife and kids. And there's more to life than trying to find my identity in something that I can't find my identity in, you know?
Right.
'Cause I'm, you know, when I look back at even all the video stuff I've done, like there's nothing I'm very, you know, satisfied in or I feel good about at this point in my life. I want to get 10 times better. I want to work harder. I want to get better jobs and, you know, do better. But I think even if that does happen and if there is a measure of success in that, I'll probably still feel just as dissatisfied with my work as I do now.
Hmm. Do you think that that's something that you've grown in the knowledge and understanding of over, you know, the 12 years of your, is it 12 years about?
Lamp Mode has been around for 12 years, 13 years.
Yeah. So, because it sounds, I mean, years. Is that something you've had to grow in embracing and learning?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt, man. Yeah. I think part of all of those experiences I went through have helped me to be freed to embrace that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard. It's a hard pill to swallow because I think a lot of what we're taught through the various forms, whether it be nature, nurture, well, whether it be like how we're raised, so to speak, what media tells us, what your friends and family members are telling you is like, you know, get a job you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Yeah, it's bull crap.
You know, like, and you'll find this thing. And even, you know, when it comes to getting married, you're going to find this woman, you're going to find this guy, you're going to buy this car, you're going to get this thing, you're going to have this kid. And then there's going to be this kind of like ultimate fulfillment that's going to happen. And from that ultimate fulfillment, you're going to have this euphoric, like this.
Right.
End. And I have noticed some of the OGs and the wiser people who've been around for a while, they kind of they kind of communicate to me that, like, huh? No, listen, it's never going to be easy. You know, you're never going to have this ultimate fulfillment. You know, what happens is you start to grow in understanding how this actually works and start to recognize that, you know, being disappointed, that's normal. Not being fully fulfilled, that's normal. And, you know, your fulfillment comes from your relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because everything else is going to let you down. Your wife, your kids, your job, your business, your ideas, even your own dreams, even you're going to let yourself down. And putting your hope and dependence in these other things, you know, and even though those of us that believe that know it, it's kind of like we need to be reminded practically on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Because we latch on to things real quick.
I think getting married has helped that too. Not that, you know, my marriage is bad or I love my wife. She's freaking amazing, but she's not ultimately satisfying, you know, and that's tough to admit. When you have this expectation of, well, marriage is going to fulfill me.
Yeah.
Which I think I had going into marriage, thinking that, oh, it's going to be, you know, the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
And not that it's bad or we haven't had a challenging marriage or a struggle, like a, you know, a long struggle or anything that has been challenging for us. But just sort of everyday, you know, reality of marriage sort of throws that in your face.
Yeah. We're all longing to be fulfilled. I think we see that. I mean, I see that all the time. And I feel that. That's not me pointing the finger at other people only. It's like, you know, you're always looking for this thing to, like they say, fill this God-sized hole.
Right.
And, you know, no matter what, you're always like, but there's still more room, you know? So, you know, it's encouraging to know. And I mean, that's one of the things that when I think about being with God forever, you know, like there's no sickness, there's no wanting, there's no longing, there's no like, oh, we were cracking jokes about how, why does a baby start screaming when it first wakes up in the bed? Right. You know, first thing it does, wakes up is, oh gosh, this world is terrible. You know, it just starts yelling. And like, no matter what, you're trying to console this baby, you get, well, here, take this, take that. And it's just like, no, nothing else will do. Right. And it's kind of like you said, that's because we would do the same thing, but we're just more mature. But in our hearts, it's kind of the same thing. We're kind of like screaming, like, I'm still not satisfied. So like the times when I get there, I'm glad that I have a hope. Eventually I will be satisfied.
Yeah, man. Know?
But it's not going to be here.
It's true.
Word. Well, I got one last question for you.
All right, hit me.
All right. So when all is said and done,
and
your legacy is the only thing that's, you know, left, how do you want, what kind of inspiration do you want to leave on your circle of influence?
Inspiration. What does that look like? What do you mean inspiration?
Well, you know, you think about when I think of inspiration, I think of being pushed, prodded, inspired, or like using the word in the definition, like encourage, like after engagement with you and engagement with the things that you've done, now there's a certain direction that I'm being pushed toward because of that. And it's not necessarily that, you know, it's going to be exactly what you wanted, but if you had a desire, what kind of long lasting effect would you like your career, your creativity, and your life to leave on the people who are in your circumference, your circle?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that.
That's a big question.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think, if anything, I want to be faithful and I want to have a unique point of view in the way, like a voice. Mm-hmm. People say a voice, you know. Like I want to find my voice and use it unashamedly, you know, no matter what. And I want to be known for being faithful to my point of view, you know. And Yeah, having it, leaving my mark on it, that is undeniably me. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm going to have, you know, the strongest point of view or whatever, because right. most people don't. They might have a more average or safe point of view, but whatever mine is, like, I want to know what it is, and yeah, be free with knowing that it's mine and not try and have someone else's perspective or do it the way that, you know, the culture dictates it should be done, or
yeah.
that trends dictate it should be done. You know, I just want to do it because I think that it looks the best way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel good about that.
Word up. Well, folks, we did it. It finally happened. Finally got Josh Wan to do this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, I put him in a submission hold, and I got him to share with the world. Appreciate it.
Yeah,
appreciate
man.
You, man.
So thanks for having me.
Where can the people find you on the social medias, the internets?
On the internets, Shot by Esso, ESSO.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And that's on Twitter,
Instagram. Yep.
Okay. And Lamp Mode is?
LampMode.com, at Lamp Mode.
Okay.
And then ScoutsHonorMedia.com.
And anything else that you want to plug? Anything else you want to shout out?
Nope.
All right. Well, if you want to follow me, I changed my Twitter because I was told that my Twitter was a mess. So my Twitter is now Octavius A. Newman. So OctavIus A. Newman.
What was it before?
It's
OA Newman.
It was Doc underscore.
Oh, yeah.
Doc. Was, you know, everybody was like, Doc, what are all these BF. Underscores and all this stuff? So I switched it
to. Wait, was that easy to change?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just went in and switched it up, and everybody seemed to just kind of flow with it.
Okay.
Easy enough.
As long as it was available, right?
Yeah, it was available.
Yeah.
Like somebody else had Octavius Newman.
Yeah, a jerk.
Well, they probably, I'm assuming that person's name is Octavius Newman, so I'm not going to be too mad at them.
Yeah.
But, you know, Octavius A. Newman on Twitter, on Instagram, Bear Fruit, at B3ARFRUIT, on Twitter and Instagram, bearfruit.com. Make sure that you go on iTunes, leave us, you know, a positive comment and 5-star rating if you see fit. You know, follow us on the social medias, on the interwebs, also going to be on SoundCloud. And we're going to try to do this more often, try to keep it up on a more consistent basis. So until next time, peace.